First question for Professor Ferrara.
Hi, I'm here. At some point you introduced a cutoff in your Born-Ehrenfeld Lagrangian. Maybe we could go to the slide where you said there was a cutoff. I believe that was after you. Further on the Born-Ehrenfeld.
His win?
Yeah, it was after that, after you introduced the F field. But you said that there has to be a
this
cutoff.
One?
Is it already, there was a cutoff mu somewhere.
Well, it's the same.
Yes. So I was wondering, what sort of cutoff is that? Is that? That's not a cutoff in momentum space, right? It's a... Or can you explain what
sense
is that?
Well, this cutoff... Well, it means that this Lagrangian is a Lagrangian which is a valid description for energies which are less than this cutoff. So it's like the Fermi theory of weak interaction. If you have energies which are much smaller than the Fermi scale or the vector boson masses, then the usual theory become an effective theory which is not normalizable, and you have the four Fermi interactions which have the four Fermi interaction have dimension 6, is an operator of dimension 6, so it has a scale 1 over m square, which is the weak interaction scale. This is precisely the same thing. This F is the analogous of the Fermi scale for the breaking of supersymmetry, and this effective action is an action which is valid for energies less than this cutoff F, which is the supersymmetry breaking scale.
Right, and you are then saying that the, is it right to say that can I think about the UV completion of this theory as the full unbroken supergravity or supersymmetry?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Popov?
What is the name? Popov. Can you speak louder?
Do you hear me? Do you hear me or not? Okay, let's speak normally, not... I thought it was this one.
No. No, doesn't work.
Fyodor Popov, ITF Moscow. It seems that Born-Ehrenfeld Lagrangian for electrodynamics it's more complicated than usual quantum electrodynamics, and it seems that it's non-renormalizable. So is it consistent to study such theory?
Okay. I didn't understand the language. You understand what?
So, is Born-Ehrenfeld theory renormalizable?
No, it's not.
So
this is an effective theory. It's like the Fermi theory of weak interaction. So it's an effective theory which is, in this framework, is an effective theory which is supposed to be valid at energies which are much lower than this cutoff, which is the square root of F, because this F has dimension energy square. So this action, if you expand in the electromagnetic field, you have a term F square, which is cut off independent because this F square cancels this 1 over F here. And then you get F to the 4th term with 1 over F square cut off and so on. You get power of the Maxwell field with inverse power of this cut off. So it's really very analogous to the approximation of the Fermi theory of weak interaction when you have energies which are much less than the Fermi scale.
Okay, thank you.
Effective theory is when theoreticians don't know what to do. They call it effective theory.
Effective theory is a power, is a very powerful mechanism because in some sense a theory which is renormalizable is too much constraint because you are assuming that this theory is valid up to any arbitrary energies. But our knowledge of the world is not at infinite energies. We'll be always at finite energies. So it is very important to have a description which is energy dependent, which is valid only for energies which are lower or some energy
as,
scale.
As I said in my opening speech, when I was 60 years younger than now, the reason why the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon needed to be measured at a per mil level is because there was an effective theory of electromagnetism which was assuming that this object called muon, which was 200 times heavier than the electron, had some interaction. And the fellow who I quoted made a computing effective theory to predict the G minus 2 anomaly. And the prediction was 1%. You know how much was the cutoff at 1 GeV?
Yeah. Yes. Because electron has a mass which is much smaller than 1 GeV.
Well,
yes.
The electron is 200 times lighter than the muon, so the argument was for an effective theory of electromagnetic phenomena. And when we measured G minus 2 was at the level 10 to minus 4.
Yes.
And this was an effective theory.
Yes,
so
exactly.
These young fellows, you should not confuse them. They should, when we don't know what to do, we say we have an effective theory. And you put the cutoff when is needed at the right level in order to predict something which can be measured. When Weisskopf computed the vacuum polarization effect experimentally discovered by Brackett, he found for the lamp shift minus 100 megacycles. No one had the idea of computing the lamp shift, not the vacuum polarization effect, which is much weaker. And the lamp shift was plus 1,000 megacycles instead of minus 100.
It was an error.
Yeah. No, an error. No. It was the fact that no theoretician ever imagined the most elementary effect. An electron emits a photon, reabsorbs the photon. And this is 1,000 megacycles. And this is how the lamp shift has been discovered, while the theoretical prediction was minus 100 megacycles for the vacuum polarization effect. So this is life. So now you have a very nice proposal, which I think is very interesting, but it is an effective theory, which means theorists don't know what they're talking.
All our theories are effective theories. Then, Jagoskin.
Taras Zagoskin, Kharkov Institute of Physics and Technology. I have a little bit technical question. Please, let's go to the slide where you define the D and H vector fields.
For D the and H, yes.
Yes, for the electromagnetic field.
Here?
I suppose it's slide 24, as I remember.
Yes?
Yes. So, looking at these two relations for D and H, let's take the simplest Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field in this theory. L equals to 1 over 2 E square minus B square. I suppose that in this case, in order to get relations D equal to E and H equal to B, we should slightly modify these two formulas.
Maybe there is a factor two wrong. I don't know. This formula gives D equal E and H equal B when you have E squared minus B squared. It's exactly what you get.
But I mean, maybe
the derivative of E squared minus B squared with respect to E is E. And the derivative of L with respect to... Oh, no, there is an error here.
Yes, we should
reply. No, no, but this is a typo. It's a typo.
E with B.
No, no, it's B.
Yes.
There is a typo.
Yeah, and we should also maybe leave out these two twos. I mean, these two numbers of two.
Well, that depends on the normalization of the Lagrangian. But this is a typo. Thank you for telling me.
Yes, so there are three typos.
Yeah. No, there is one. The factor two depends on the normalization. But I agree. This is a simply a typo.
Because we want to get the equations in vacuum, and that's why we should
leave these two
out. Okay.
You're right.
He should get the prize. Gerardo, what is the name of this fellow? Jack Hoskin. We should not forget.
Are there further questions?
This is there. On the left.
On the left. All there.
Yes. John Sola from Barcelona. This morning I intended to ask you about the situation of the cosmological constant problem in supergravity, because in the case of global supersymmetry we have exactly zero vacuum energy. In supergravity we can fine-tune things and perhaps we can in principle improve the situation, but I would like you to explain why this is not so easy.
Can I use the... This morning I only talk marginally about supergravity. But the point is that... Ah, okay. I need also the... Well, I was saying what happens is that in supergravity, the transformation law of the fermion, there is a word identity which tells you that the transformation law of the fermion, chi is a fermion, under supersymmetry, is given by a term which is delta B times the potential, plus another term which in fact has a minus sign and is related to the gravitino mass matrix. So in supergravity, you can have, unlike in rigid supersymmetry, if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken or is broken, you can have a cancellation between these two terms. A cancellation which allows you to have zero vacuum energy. Well, a cancellation between these two terms, which allows you to have zero vacuum energy, even if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. Because there is a negative contribution coming from the gravitino, and this negative contribution allows you to have spontaneous symmetry breaking in supergravity with zero cosmological constant. In fact, a class of models which realize this are these models where actually also Nino gave a contribution, these famous no-scale models. The no-scale models are example of models where the cosmological constant is zero from the beginning, because there is an exact cancellation between a negative term and a positive term in the scalar potential. Generically, you don't solve the problem of the cosmological constant. The only thing that you can say is that in supergravity, when supersymmetry is broken, you can have a zero cosmological constant or a very small cosmological constant which is not in conflict with experimental data. But there is a fine-tuning problem which is difficult to solve. There is no mathematical solution of the fine-tuning problem. Otherwise, you would have solved the problem of the cosmological constant. The only thing is that you can make models where supersymmetry is broken and the cosmological constant vanishes. And no-scale models are a realization of this phenomenon.
But in fact, sorry, it's not only that the cosmological constant vanishes, because there is this second term with the negative sign. So it could be that the ground state is just does not coincide with the point where the cosmological constant is zero.
It can, it cannot. It depends on the model.
It cannot. So
yeah,
in fact,
even
if you adjust the two terms to cancel,
yeah, exactly.
It could be that the vacuum state is still lower. So then it means that it's not a physical point.
Well, that depends on the model. I mean, you have to know an explicit model, and then you have to see whether it's a critical point or not. I mean, but in no-scale model, it is indeed a critical point, because in no-scale models, the potential is semi-positive definite. So if the potential is semi-positive definite, of course, the point of zero potential is a critical point. And this is exactly what happens in no-scale models.
Okay, thank you. There's a question by Professor Minkowski.
If we imagine a verification...
Touch it. Ignore it.
Oh.
Okay.
Speak
normally. No problem. No, don't speak here. Speak there.
Okay. If you think, in principle, of determining the scale of this SUSY breaking through the processes you described in the Lagrangian, let's take some example, neutrino gamma scattering, which is not easily measurable, but there the effects must turn up, not only in production of gravitino and another supersymmetric particle, but also in the T-channel, what you're used to. Can this, in principle, be worked out in a certain well-defined approximation, so that one can, in principle, theoretically, study the effects of the scale of the gravitino as you described it in broken supersymmetry?
Well, I think this is what Pierre Fayet did at the beginning of supersymmetry, using low-energy theorem to see processes involving gravitinos. Exactly. Yeah.
More. I have just one question for you, myself. There is one. Oh, there. Okay, you first.
Thank you. Like you explained before, if there's a Rob Knops, CERN TH, if there's a cancellation between an F term and a D term to obtain a vanishing cosmological constant, is this invariant for under UV corrections?
Is?
Under quantum corrections.
Well, you don't need to have... you're talking about supergravity. Well, in supergravity, you don't need to have a cancellation between F and D term for having vanishing cosmological constant. So the D term can vanish itself, and the F term doesn't give a positive contribution, so you can have a cancellation... and this is, in fact, what usually happens. I mean, you have an F-term contribution which has zero vacuum energy because of the cancellation. The reason why in supergravity there is this negative term, which is not present in rigid supersymmetry, is because supersymmetry allows to have anti-de Sitter vacua. So you can have unbroken supersymmetry with a non-zero cosmological constant, provided that this cosmological constant is negative. And this is what is called anti-de Sitter supersymmetry. So there are two supersymmetric vacua. One is anti de Sitter, which however is a disastrous vacua for cosmology. It's not an interesting vacuum because there would be a collapse of the universe with an anti de Sitter vacuum. But in principle, there is an unbroken supersymmetry which can exist both in Minkowski and anti de Sitter. And the negative energy which you have in supergravity, which cancels the positive term of the matter contribution, is due to this phenomenon.
So, my own question, since you have supersymmetry breaking terms, usually soft supersymmetry breaking terms, why cannot the cosmological constant then be anything? It's softer than anybody else.
Indeed, it can be anything. I mean, there is no explanation of banishing cosmological constant in supersymmetry.
Okay. Because I had the impression, well, just before you said the cosmological constant has to be negative or so.
No. Well, the only thing that you know is that the cosmological constant will never be of order n Planck to the 4, but will be proportional to the soft breaking masses, to the supersymmetry breaking terms. So that is already a hierarchical suppression of the cosmological constant. But, I mean, whether the cosmological constant is almost zero, there is no prediction from supersymmetry. And this is, I think, I was clear. A supersymmetry doesn't solve the cosmological constant problem.
Not either way. Not why it's positive, not why it's negative, not why it is zero or non-zero.
No. From the point of view of supersymmetry, the cosmological constant can be positive, negative, or when supersymmetry is broken, you can have three kinds of vacua. Oh, yeah. When supersymmetry is unbroken, the Sitter vacua are excluded. But when supersymmetry is broken, you can have the Sitter, anti-de Sitter, or Minkowski, depending on the model. Of course, in inflationary model, you can in fact make a supersymmetric model which has, during inflation, a de Sitter vacuum. But that doesn't mean that you have a no-go theorem from supersymmetry about the cosmological constant. You can only show that the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking is compatible with the possibility of having an almost zero cosmological constant, and eventually in the de Sitter phase during inflation.
More questions? Then I'd like to thank Professor Ferrara for very nice lectures.